Welcome to Life in Debt, your practical debt education program. This is bankruptcy attorney Robert Liptak. I'm speaking from Crew LP 100.1 FM, the voice of Fairfield, Iowa, an award-winning, listener-supported, open-source, grassroots, and partially solar-powered community radio station broadcasting from the Cultural District in Fairfield. Please note that these presentations are provided as a public service for general information purposes only and are not intended to be legal opinions, legal advice, or complete discussions of any legal issues. Remember, every individual's factual situation is different, and you should seek independent legal advice from an attorney familiar with the laws of your state or locality regarding specific information. The name of this show is Life and Debt, and it is a weekly half-hour educational show looking at all types of issues related to debt as it influences your life. This show provides practical, general knowledge about what to look for regarding debt, what are its traps and pitfalls, and what to do to be an educated debtor. Please get some notebook, paper, and pen to take notes during the show. First, we look at some debt-related news and facts for the week. Congress has introduced a bill to eliminate mortgage servicing conflicts of interest. There are thousands of troubled mortgages in need of modification, but some think there is a conflict of interest that may be preventing large mortgage companies from voluntarily offering modification services. Many large mortgage companies own second mortgages on the same homes that they service, but these secondary mortgages are an investment, potentially creating a conflict of interest. In hopes of eliminating this issue, House Reps Brad Miller, Democrat from North Carolina, and Keith Ellison, Democrat from Minnesota, both members of the Financial Services Committee, have introduced the Mortgage Servicing Conflict of Interest Elimination Act. Two-thirds of all distressed mortgages are now serviced by the four largest banks, Bank of America, Wells Fargo, Chase, and Citibank. And these same banks also own about $477 billion in second liens. If enacted, the new legislation would prohibit mortgage servicers from owning debt secured by a home that secures a mortgage they service. Servicers are required to act in the best interests of the investors who own the mortgages, Miller said. In many, those four banks hold interests in other debt secured by the same home that would be affected by a decision to modify the mortgage or to foreclose, placing the bank's interests in irreconcilable conflict with the interests of the investors. Ellison said this obvious conflict of interest between investors and servicers may well be a factor in the failure of servicers to modify mortgages voluntarily. The bill would give servicers a reasonable amount of time to divest themselves either of any interests in home mortgages or of the authority to service mortgages. The likely outcome would be that the four biggest banks would spin off their mortgage servicing business, which would resolve the conflict of interest and result in smaller, less complex banks. And from the comingdepression.net, what bankers won't tell you about owning a home. The home is not the asset. The mortgage payer is the asset. The revenue generated by mortgage interest is where the banks make their money. People looking to secure their future are constantly bombarded with the rhetoric of real estate agents and banks that your home is an investment. The rise in home equity that you call wealth is phony because inflation is caused by central banking, is not taken into account. Homes historically appreciate at a rate at or near the rate of inflation, so the net benefit over time is practically nil. Add to this the cost of mortgage principal, interest, taxes, which often increase as a result of assessed value, maintenance and utilities, and you have yourself a money sinkhole. Even if you sell a home that has risen rapidly in value, you generally have to buy another home that has risen just as much in value. Smart investors know that homes are not assets, they're liabilities. Assets generate income, homes deplete income. Ever notice how banks, upon foreclosure of a house, will quickly sell it? Banks don't wait for homes to appreciate in value because of the expenses involved in maintenance. The home is not the asset. The mortgage payer is the asset. The revenue generated by mortgage interest is where the banks make their money. Banks and real estate agents have conned an entire generation into believing that their home is their number one investment. The more debt slaves there are, the better off the leeches in the banking and real estate world would be. Really, have you ever wondered what mortgage means? It is a combination of two French words, of mort, death, and gage, contract. So you are essentially signing a death pledge or contract when taking a loan out for a house. It's total brainwashing when it comes to investment. Viewed purely as an investment, an owner-occupied home has more than a few undesirable traits. In January, during a panel discussion at the annual meeting of the American Economists Association, Karen Pence, head of the Federal Reserve Household and Real Estate Finance Division, pointed out a few of the drawbacks buyers tend to overlook. For instance, a house can't be divided up and sold, like a stock portfolio, and it is highly correlated to the job market. Also, a house is undiversified. Instead, its future is tied to a single neighborhood. In essence, the current system is not true capitalism. The government is using taxpayer dollars to insure bank loans to what would otherwise be considered underqualified borrowers, all in the name of keeping prices artificially inflated. That's not capitalism, that's corporate socialism. In a true capitalistic society, banks would be more conservative with their lending. If not, they would go under when the bubble inevitably bursts, and the bankers who authorized risky loans would end up on the street where they belong. If banks knew that their own money was on the line, that is, not insured by big government, it would be guaranteed that they would require a 25% down payment and wouldn't risk an amortization period longer than 25 years. That was the norm for decades before the big government got involved.
Does anyone really think the so-called industry experts would actually come out and openly promote the existence of a bubble?
Bank economists on business programs only mention places that are pricey. We live in a society of politically correct. Want to bet lenders are not possibly tightening their lending criteria behind the scene? And Peter Schiff purports that the housing prices are about to drop. By transferring more underwater mortgage balances onto the public books, the plan puts taxpayers on the hook to further losses if housing prices continue to fall. Given the massive support for real estate already afforded by record low interest rates and massive federal tax and policy incentives, there are very good reasons to believe that home prices will indeed collapse when these crutches are removed. Recent spikes in long-term interest rates warn of this prospect. If the administration had allowed losses to fall where they rightfully belong, namely on those who foolishly loaded up on toxic mortgage bonds, then the housing market would have already found its true clearing level. Instead, every measure is working to prolong and delay the ultimate reckoning while setting up taxpayers as the patsy. Given the horrendous government deficit projects for the next several years, any losses incurred by the government mortgage portfolio may add a critical stress on America's fiscal viability. Bottom line is houses should not be looked at as investments, but rather as a home, a place to raise your family, a place to create a community, and all of the attendant psychological and emotional benefits that go with home ownership. If you're just tuning in, this is bankruptcy attorney Robert Liptak, and this program is Life and Debt, your practical debt education program. I'm speaking from Crew LP 100.1 FM, the voice of Fairfield, Iowa, and beyond. Now I will continue with the educational segment based on the book, The Two Income Trap, which we've been looking over in great detail over many of the past shows. It's Why Middle-Class Parents Are Going Broke. It's written by Elizabeth Warren and her daughter, Amelia Warren Tyagi. whose thoughts, ideas, and examples used in these programs are directly from or based on their work, theories, and books, which I highly recommend, All Your Worth and The Two Income Trap. Also, you could revisit all of the shows that have been produced for Life in Debt at www.kruufm.com under the Archives, Life and Debt section to bring you up to date on all of the past topics and educational discussions related to debt in its many forms. Last week, I was talking about the condition of a divorced, newly single mother and how that condition related to the so-called feminist dream, the better educated woman earning far more than her sisters of a generation ago. But we saw that in the wake of the divorce, she will learn just how far she can and will probably fall. We ended with a comparison looking at a generation ago, where the married couple, the typical one-earner family in the 70s, had 46% of the husband's income left over once the housing, health insurance, and other fixed expenses, those basic necessities, had been paid. If they had split up as a couple back in 1970, the wife's discretionary income, once she collected child support payments and found a new job, would fall to just 19% of the family's pre-divorce income. Obviously, that's a staggering drop, making it tough for the newly formed fatherless household to survive a generation ago. But things are worse for today's working mothers, despite what we had said about improved education and earning power and child support collection. Today, the two-earner married family starts out just slightly better off than the divorced woman of a generation ago, with only 25% of income available for food, utilities, clothing, and all other discretionary purchases. So, if today's two-parent family is squeezed, the post-divorce mother is crushed. If we take the typical two-earner family in the last decade, the wife's discretionary income would drop to a mere 4% of the family's pre-divorce income, even after she collects child support. The middle-class life she had and her husband once provided for their children would vanish. And as Professor Warren points out, the bad news isn't over. The public face of divorce implies that the biggest struggle facing a divorcing couple is the fight over who gets what. Very famous case was Donald and Ivana Trump. Or another one is General Electric CEO Jack Welch and the ex-wife who broadcast his lavish compensation package to an eager public. We see long protracted battles, plenty of the he said, she said drama, and the debates in the local newspapers over who deserved what, which of course makes for juicy stories. But today's middle-class families don't just split up the home, the bank accounts, and the kids. They must also split up the debt. And unlike the bank accounts, they don't get just 50% apiece. They each face 100% responsibility for any debts they both signed their names to, so the co-debtor status. When a husband and a wife file for divorce, they may tear up the contract between themselves, but they cannot tear up their obligations to the rest of the world. And sometimes this is a very expensive lesson in the law of legal liability. Many people keep their businesses, for example, afloat on the couple's credit cards, and often one of the two is not working in the business and didn't have anything to do with what happened. Now, the family court judge may agree with the injured spouse and order the ex to pay child support and to pay off all the couple's debt. That happens. But what if the business has failed and the responsible spouse, or that is ex-spouse, can't find a high-paying job?
but is forced into odd jobs at minimum wage. What happens is he's not paying back any of the credit card or utility bills. The interest is continuing. There are penalties, late charges, and these compound month after month. While the injured spouse is believing that everything is being paid. What you see is that this will eventually swell to very large sums of debt owed by, in fact, both of the parties. What happens is that if the originally responsible business owner working at a much less productive job doesn't have anything to pay for the amassed debt, the other injured party will get sued. And that party will discover that in the eyes of the law that governs debtors and creditors, it doesn't matter who ran the family business or what agreement the couple had worked out between themselves. If both names are on the original loan documents, and if one spouse misses a payment, the creditors have every legal right and every incentive to go after the other one. And that holds true regardless of what the divorce court orders. The couple may decide not to share their lives any longer, but their economic fortunes will remain united for years. Of course, there may be in that divorce decree an indemnification clause and a hold harmless provision, but that really is based on the fact that, in this example, the party running the business and using the credit cards was continuing to have some income to be able to hold the injured party harmless and to indemnify that party. However, the creditor suing could care less about that, and it may just be a flimsy or meaningless provision, particularly if the injured party does have some assets, a good job, with some income for the creditor or debt collector to go after. That party can get garnished in spite of the divorce decree.
A generation ago, when the average family didn't even have a credit card, post-divorce debt splitting wasn't all that important. But today, a family begins divorce proceedings deep in a financial hole, oftentimes, so that negotiating who pays which debts can be a matter of survival. Sometimes the judge will simply split the debt down the middle, ordering each to pay half. In other cases, the judge will order lower child support payments in return for a father's commitment to take on the whole load of debt. One way or another, both parents pay for the fact that they face divorce already awash in red ink. Over the past generation, average savings have dropped from 11% of income to -1%, while credit card debt has climbed from 4% of income to 12%. As a consequence, the mother starts out her post-divorce life today with higher fixed costs, more debt, and less money in the bank, which is a recipe for financial disaster. If you're just tuning in, this is bankruptcy attorney Robert Liptak, and this program is Life and Debt, your practical debt education program. I'm speaking from Crew LP 100.1 FM, the voice of Fairfield, Iowa, and beyond. And I've been talking about the financial challenges and setup for a modern divorced mother. And at this point, I'd like to point out how incredibly important it is for people who are facing divorce to see an attorney who knows about and specializes in debt relief. The reason for that is because that attorney can work with the divorce attorney and lead the entire situation for you in a way that will minimize exposure for debt issues post-divorce. This has to happen before the divorce takes place, so the language of the agreement and the divorce decree benefit you, particularly if you're going to be a single mom, but also the husband who is now going to be a single dad, being severed from a two-income family to two heads of households having debt
that really needed two incomes to attend to. But let's get back to the financial disaster. The single mother is under enormous pressure to scale back, but scaling back is now harder than ever. A generation ago, she had to compete with male breadwinner families for a house in the suburbs. Everything that defined a middle-class life for children in her community, decent schools, a safe car, health insurance, was typically purchased with the income of a higher-earning male, which made it tough for a divorced mother to keep up. The women's movement promised to make things easier for these women, since a bigger paycheck was supposed to translate into financial security for single mothers. But this formula missed one important fact. Single mothers weren't the only ones to enter the workforce. Married mothers went to work, too.
For every increase in the paycheck of a single mother, there is now a corresponding increase in a married couple's income as well. As a growing number of married mothers enter the workforce, the income gap between single and married parents is growing, notwithstanding rising wages for single mothers.
In the mid-1970s, a typical married couple with children earned $29,800, inflation adjusted, more than the average single mother. Today, that gap is more than $41,000. No matter how hard she works, how many hours extra she puts in, or training sessions she attends, the modern single mother will never be able to catch up. As Professor Warren says, this is very ironic. Lured by the promise of financial security for themselves and their children, millions of women marched into the workforce. And yet, if their husbands leave, they discover that despite their growing paychecks, they are in no position to compete in a two-income world. Also, the post-divorce woman must deal with the fact that she and her ex had built a middle-class life that depended on two incomes, and now she must cope without that second paycheck. By all predictions, the middle-class single mother should be better off than her counterpart of any generation before her. Yet, despite her education, her work experience, and the support of the courts, the modern single mother is more likely to face financial failure than ever before.
Professor Warren continues her discussion regarding the facts of marriage, and what she points out is that some women take an alternate path to survive the economic blows by remarrying. We know that marriage, even a second marriage, is supposed to be about chemistry and companionship, but getting a foreclosure notice can make anyone rethink what she really needs from a relationship. Professor Warren says that even now, a generation after the women's revolution, the surest way for a woman to regain her financial footing after a divorce is to find a husband and to do it quickly. And of course, this isn't just something that she's making up. She's basing this on statistical analysis and articles that she has gathered. Because when a woman in this circumstance thinks about it, she can say to herself that one quick way out of her economic hole is that if I was to get married again and he had only a part-time salary, then I could make it. The irony is that in a world of economic hurt, even a guy with half a job looks good. So that's one part of the picture. Now, what about the mother who was never married to begin with? The majority of single mothers in bankruptcy are divorced or separated, but there are some who never had a husband. Divorced women got into trouble when they lost one of their incomes they were counting on. But how did mothers who never married end up in trouble? For some, the answer is pretty much the same as for their divorced sisters. A guy moved out. Although they weren't legally married, many were in long-term relationships. When the couple broke up, these women went through an economic, if not a legal, divorce, and they were sent into the same kind of economic tailspin as their previously married sisters.
Other unmarried mothers never had a partner to begin with, but they learned that with only one adult in the household, even a short period of unemployment or a medium-sized medical bill could send them from survival to collapse in a few months. So what about making the dad pay more? Well, the typical picture is that the dad moves out, he rents an apartment, often his new girlfriend moves in, at least for a while, then often she moves out, because he's probably struggling financially and so he's no fun anymore. But what happens is that when he looks at the net income from his paycheck, he doesn't have much left. When the expenses are all taken into consideration, including child support, a guy like this is often living just above the poverty line. He often loses his health insurance. When a job is a new job, a startup job, from having lost, for example, an outsourced job. And then, of course, there's the attorney's fees for the divorce. A guy like this is often living in an empty shell apartment, nothing but a television, perched on a box, an old couch that falls out into a bed, and a card table in the kitchen. He often has teetering relationships with kids that he can only see sporadically. And, of course, not a whole lot of money left over to entertain anyone or have a life. So making the dad pay more doesn't seem like it's going to work. Then how can the single parent family get out of the trap? Again, the solution that is always presented is make the dad pay more. Politicians say that, women's groups say that, and angry mothers say that. It's a great emotionally appealing argument. And it resonates with some of our most basic values: equity between men and women, following through on commitments, protecting our children. It also fits with common sense. After all, everyone knows some unfortunate woman who is having a dreadful time making ends meet since she got stiffed by her ex. And we have all heard news reports about the men who were absconding without making their payments. The experts of a generation ago and today predicted with such confidence that better child support enforcement would ensure financial security for single mothers. But does increasing child support really hold the key to survival for millions of middle-class single mothers? Do ex-husbands hold the untapped wealth that single mothers need for financial security, and all that we have to do is seek it out and get it? Well, America has spent a generation hunting down the devious deadbeat dad, but single mothers are in more trouble than ever, according to the statistics by Professor Warren. It doesn't come through in most news reports, but the overwhelming majority of middle-class fathers today pay the support they owe and were struggling personally. According to one survey, non-resident fathers who earned more than $30,000 a year reported that they were paying more than 95% of their court-ordered child support. And this was supported by other surveys.
Among fathers who were steadily employed, which includes a number of men who work for low wages, 80% of their ex-wives reported receiving full payment. These numbers stand as a reminder that there is not much left to collect. Additional enforcement of child support can provide only limited help to struggling middle-class women and their children.
So there's more going on in this picture than meets the eye, and we will continue next week. If you're just tuning in, this is bankruptcy attorney Robert Liptak, and you have been listening to Life in Debt, your debt education program. If you have any questions or comments, call the station at 641-209-1083, or you can email me at lifeanddebt@gmail.com. I'm speaking from Crew LP 100.1 FM, the voice of Fairfield, Iowa. May you enjoy and have a healthy and prosperous debt manageable life.